Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. For readers, the Seminary Co-op Bookstores are a literary paradise because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Richard Thaler's and Cass Sunstein's Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, just published by Yale University Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Blue Ballier's wonderful new book, The Calder Game, with illustrations by Brett Hellquist, published by Scholastic Press. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Alberto Mangel's Library at Night, also just released by Yale University Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and semcoop.com. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Alexander Hamon, whose book, The Lazarus Project, will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
That's what we like to hear. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, and welcome to Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman, and this is the last event of the fourth season of Writers on the Record. It is also the last event in this fantastic space of Looking Glass Theater. It's not the last time that the generous supporters of MavenChronicles.com are going to be underwriting this, which is also fantastic. And I want to remind everybody that we are on the stage of Around the World in 80 Days, which ends June 1st. It's a great show. And, you know, I know I've confused people because a couple months ago I said that Writers on the Record was going to end after the fourth season. Today we are going to be talking in a little while to Alexander Hamon about his book, The Lazarus Project. And so it occurred to me that this theme of resurrection was really appropriate today because Writers on the Record is, in fact, going to continue not just in the form of a taped interview, which is what I had then thought, but actually right here today, I need to announce the ending of one fantastic collaboration, but the start of a new one. And beginning in September, the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center is going to be the new place that Writers on the Record will find a home starting in September. So that's just a fantastic thing. But, on the other hand, the collaboration that's existed up to this point has been such a remarkable one. It started 4 years ago, and I just have to take this moment, please just, you know, indulge me, to thank some of the people who made it possible. First of all, the Looking Glass Theater, they did not have to do this. Nobody had a gun to their back. The fact that they've hosted it here for 4 years has been just a fantastic place for us to be, and any of you who have been in the audience here have known what a dynamic organization this is. So I want to thank the executive director, Rachel Kraft, and also the director of production, Alexandra Blunt, who have been very, very good-natured about keeping this here all this time. Also, Tammy Becker, if any of you have bought coffee in the last 4 years, these people schlep down here on Sundays when they don't have to serve us coffee and sell water. And so Tammy's been fantastic. But Chad Walkup, who is the house manager, this guy has two little kids and a wife at home. He could be sleeping right now. And instead he comes here and he opens the theater for us. So I really thank them from the bottom of my heart. Also, Chicago Magazine. When I went to Dick Babcock, the editor in Big Kahuna of the magazine 4 years ago with this crazed idea to team up with Looking Glass and WFMT You know, he could have laughed, but instead he said, yeah, let's do that. Let's start this column and let's do this thing. He has been an incredible support and advisor, and I'm going to miss that, Dick. But he's been just such a terrific help for all of this. I sometimes called and said, what do you think? Richard Russo, Martin Amis, who do we go for? And he always sort of had it spot on. Cassie Walker was the editor of the Q&A in Chicago Magazine, which has been a really great kind of adjunct thing that's really helped promote this all along. I'm going to really miss it. And Pauline Shee, I have mercilessly hounded for the last few years, who took all of your RSVPs and noted everything and your names and phone numbers, and man, did I drive her insane. And then finally, even though this will be continuing as a broadcast on WFMT, and I do thank Steve Robinson for continuing it, Eric Arunas, up there, always pleasant, always helpful, has been the sound guru since the start. So thank you. Can we all just give them all a hand? They've been fantastic. Yeah. And they're all going to have their Sundays back once a month, which I'm sure they're thrilled about. They're all going to go out after this and have a celebratory glass of champagne that it's over. But I wanted to go out of the series here at Looking Glass on a really high note. And so for the first time in 4 years, I have invited back an author who was, he's been here before. Sasha Alexander Heyman was here in the very first season, not with a new book published at that time, but because he had just received the MacArthur Genius Grant. So I guess the question is, when the MacArthur Foundation hands out their genius award, do we believe them? You know, a lot of people do. This guy here, if you look at the reviews from his two books and now his new one, this is a word that comes up again and again. Heyman was selected in 2004 at that point in recognition for two books he had previously published. In 2000, a book of short stories, The Question of Bruno. And then in 2002, his crypto quasi-novel, he did not call it a novel, he said it was elected a novel, Nowhere Man. But I think it's also in recognition of his extraordinary life story that perhaps also has made us familiar with Heyman, and if anything, he's a genius at presenting himself to the world in a very unique and beautiful and compelling way. And so here are the cliff notes, if you're not familiar with this. Because it is sort of like the myth of Alexander Heyman and how he came to us. He arrived in Chicago, was here in 1992 on a cultural exchange program. Bad luck or good luck, he was exiled here in a way when war broke out in his hometown of Sarajevo on the day he was meant to return. He was in his late 20s at the time, had a kind of tourist grasp of English, but decided that within 5 years he was going to learn the language fluently. He published or wrote his first short story in English within 3 years. And very soon after that, his work was being published in The New Yorker to incredible acclaim. He was stuck in a series of menial jobs, but he was able to turn an experience that maybe would have, ruined a lot of people into something that was not just positive, but that he was able to share with the entire world. He has been lauded by pretty much everybody. And, of course, there was that MacArthur Prize in 2004. Although recently I have to say the one thing I don't really agree with is that the Tribune compared his skull last week to a large, deadly cannonball in an article they wrote about him. I don't agree with that, but it is my great pleasure to welcome back Alexander Heyman.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. With your book, The Lazarus Project, by the way. And this was a book that, interestingly, was inspired by another book that you read. And even, I think, more specifically than that, a photograph that you saw reproduced in that book, The Accidental, An Accidental Anarchist, by Walter Roth and Joe Krause. Can you talk about what sounded almost like an aha, like lightning bolt moment of this is what I want to write about next?
Well, I read history books randomly because I like reading history books. And a friend of mine gave me this book because he thought I would be interested, and he was right. I like not only history, but Chicago history interests me. And so I read this book, which outlines the Lazarus Averbuch case and the aftermath, which is the real story is significantly different from the story in my book. But the book also contained two photos of Lazarus Averbuch dead, sitting in a chair. In one of those photos, a police captain is holding up his head. Both of them are facing the camera. And Lazarus has his eyes closed, whereas police captain, Captain Evans, he's glaring at the camera triumphantly. He has a very neatly trimmed beard and a bowler hat. And it's a very haunting photo. But an even more haunting photo is the other photo, in which Captain Evans has moved. This photographing required a long exposition. So he has moved in the middle of photo taking. And so his face is smeared. And there's this paradoxical visual sensation. Captain Evans looks like a ghost, whereas Lazarus, who is dead and is not moving consequently, he's more present in the photo. He has the identity in the photo of a human being, whereas Captain Evans is, you know, halfway into vanishing, as it were. And when I saw those photos, I realized I would have to write a book, or at least that triggered my realization. I would have to write a book, and not only that I would have to include those photos in the book.
Okay, but to back up just slightly, for people who aren't familiar with Lazarus Averbuch, because actually it was, I mean, you have resurrected that too, not to keep, you know, kicking that. I try not to refer to resurrection anymore today. But the Lazarus Averbuch case was true. It was the story in 1908 of an immigrant, a Jewish immigrant to Chicago, who was murdered under very mysterious and brutal circumstances in the home of the chief of police at the time. And even though the first chapter of this book is the imagined last moments in the life of this 19-year-old who survived a pogrom in his country and was only here for 8 months before being murdered and held up on display like that, there's so many things that what happens in the second chapter is when we meet Brick, the contemporary 2004 protagonist, who relates very specifically, identifies with this immigrant and with the whole idea of coming to this country to pursue a kind of American dream and having that dream fail.
Well, Lazarus Averbuch, another thing that attracted me to the story, if attraction is the right category, is that his story is so tragic. He had been here only for 8 months, as you said, and hadn't really had a chance to figure it out, as it were. It was clear that he was unhappy for whatever reason. When he went to Shippy's door, Shippy said that as soon as he saw him, he knew he was an anarchist because he looked, I think the original words were Armenian or Sicilian. That is his. He was dark-skinned. It is unclear. There's no mystery that Shippy killed him, and Shippy acknowledged this, obviously. And, you know, he had a large number of witnesses, except they were all part of his family who were working for him. What is unclear is why he went to Shippy's door. And that has not been resolved, not even by Walter Roth and Joe Kraus. Some said that it was because he wanted a reference letter of a kind from Shippy, because he was planning to move west. And where he came from in Russia, you needed a letter from the police chief so he could move within the Russian Empire. But that doesn't seem to be too likely. Brick, he doesn't so much identify with Lazarus because Lazarus has clearly suffered more, as he's interested in this tragic story and the tragedy also involving Olga, his sister. And he also, Brick, is a navel gazer, which also means that he's not always clear about what he wants. So he needs to go back to Chisinau, which is Chisinau today in Moldova, and try to figure out what might have happened to Lazarus. He follows the inverse trajectory of Lazarus's journey, and he recruits a photographer whose name is Rora, his high school acquaintance, to go with him.
Why don't we read from the second chapter? The first chapter really is the imagined moments of Lazarus's, you know, last few hours, and all taking place in Chicago. And it's a very touching chapter that's also interspersed with what I presume to be in italics, the real words of William Miller from the Chicago Tribune, who reported on the Lazarus Averbuch murder at that point.
Well, I made up William P. Miller, but some of those newspaper quotes, I in fact, they do come from the newspaper reporting of the day, and some of it I just made up, you know, following the style, which was a lot of fun.
But wait, the second chapter, we're about to meet Brick for the first time after we've already met Lazarus.
Yes, this is where Brick enters. I am a reasonably loyal citizen of a couple of countries. In America, that somber land, I waste my vote, pay taxes grudgingly, share my life with a native wife, and try hard not to wish painful death to the idiot president. But I also have a Bosnian passport I seldom use. I go to Bosnia for heartbreaking vacations and funerals, and on or around March 1st, with other Chicago Bosnians, I proudly and dutifully celebrate our Independence Day with an appropriately ceremonious dinner. Strictly speaking, the Independence Day is February 29th, a typically Bosnian convolution. I suppose it would be too weird and unsovereignly to celebrate it every leap year, so it is an annual chaotic affair taking place at some suburban hotel. Bosnians come in droves and early, parking their cars. They might run into a fight over a parking space for the disabled, a couple of men swinging their crutches at each other, trying to determine who might be more impaired. While waiting in the vestibule for no discernible reason to enter the preposterously named dining hall, Westchester, Windsor, or Lake Tahoe, my fellow double citizens smoke, as numerous signs inform them that smoking is strictly prohibited. Once the door is open, they rush toward the white-clothed tables with an excess of glasses and utensils, driven by a poor people's affliction, the timeless feeling that plenty never means enough for all. They spread the napkins in their laps, they hang them on their chests. They have a hard time explaining to the wait staff that they would like to eat their salad with the main dish, not before it. They make disparaging remarks about the food, which then turn into contemptuous contemplation of American obesity. And pretty soon, whatever meager Americanness has been accrued in the past decade or so entirely evaporates for the night. Everybody, myself included, is solidly Bosnian. Everybody has an instructive story about cultural differences between us and them. Of these things, I sometimes wrote. Americans, we are bound to agree, go out after they wash their hair with their hair still wet, even in the winter. We concede that no sane Bosnian mother would ever allow her child to do that, as everybody knows that going out with your hair wet commonly results in lethal brain inflammation. At this point, I usually attest that my American wife, even though she's a neurosurgeon, a brain doctor, mind you, does the same thing. Everybody around the table shakes their head, concerned not only about her health and welfare, but about the dubious prospects of my intercultural marriage as well. Someone is likely to mention the baffling absence of draft in the United States. Americans keep all of their windows open, and they don't care if they are exposed to draft, although it is well known that being exposed to severe airflow might cause brain inflammation. In my country, we are suspicious of free-flowing air. Inevitably, over the dessert, the war is discussed. First, in terms of battles or massacres unintelligible to someone like me who has not experienced the horrors. Eventually, the conversation turns to funny ways of not dying. Everyone is roaring with laughter, and our guests who do not speak Bosnian would never know that the amusing stories say about the many dishes based on nettles, nettle pie, nettle pudding, nettle steak, or about a certain Salko who survived a mob of murderous Chetniks by playing dead, and now is dancing over there, and someone points him out, the skinny, sinewy survivor soaking his shirt with the sweat of lucky resurrection. In the official part of the evening, cultural diversity, ethnic tolerance, and Allah are praised, and there's always a series of prideful speeches, followed by a program celebrating the brain inflammation-free arts and culture of the Bosnian-Herzegovinian people. A choir of kids of uneven height and width, which always reminds me of the Chicago skyline, struggles with a traditional Bosnian song, their hearing and accent forever altered by American teenagehood. They dance too, the kids, under the approving gaze of a mustache dance coach. The girls are wearing headscarves, silky ballooning trousers, and short vests foregrouting their nascent bosoms. The boys wear fezes and felt pants. No one in the audience has ever worn such clothes in their lives. The costume fantasies are enacted to recall a dignified past divested of evil and poverty. I participate in that self-deception. In fact, I like to help with it, for at least once a year I am a Bosnian patriot. Just like everybody else, I enjoy the unearned nobility of belonging to one nation and not another. I like deciding who can join us, who is out, and who is to be welcome when visiting. The dance performance is also supposed to impress potential American benefactors who are far more likely to fork out their charitable money in support of the Association of Bosnian Americans if convinced that our culture is nothing like theirs, so that they can exhibit their tolerance and help our unintelligible customs to be preserved forever like a fly in resin.
Alexander Heyman, reading from the Lazarus Project. Thank you.
Thank you.
So one moment later, Brick, who is already conflicted about being Bosnian, being American, being married to an American, but trying to sort of straddle two worlds, finds his friend Rora, whom he hasn't seen in decades, and they went to high school together. And Rora, he sees, is this character who, even in high school, he said, had already completed the work of becoming himself. He's very self-assured. He told wild, possibly fabricated stories about his incredible life. And even then, Brick was enthralled to him to the point where he had sex fantasies about some of these women that Rora might have made up, you know, when they were 13. And to meet this fellow again, it's almost as though Rora, the photographer, and Brick, the navel-gazing writer, almost enter in what seems like a codependent relationship. They need each other. Rora to take the photographs that Brick needs to illustrate this a life that he's trying to recreate about Lazarus, and Rora really needs Brick as a witness to his own life.
Rora is a character. This is how I imagined him, who is has this epic dimension. I mean, epic in a sense of, you know, classic epic poems like the Odyssey or the Iliad or the Aeneid. In as much as he, when he enters the narrative, he's completed. There's no development. A character like Ulysses, for instance, there's no history of his life and psychology development that makes him a hero that he is in the epic. He enters it, he's complete, and he shows who he is through action and then sometimes through telling stories. So I wanted Rora to be someone like that. There's no, when he tells his stories, they're not stories about himself as much as stories in which he features as a character. And those stories are, even though he might be in them, they're not personal. And this is in clear opposition to Brick, who almost always talks about himself. And also he analyzes himself and constantly talks about his position in the trajectory of his development as a person with all the complications of having a bicultural life. So the two of them, they're the exactly opposite. And the way I imagine the book is that from the marriage of these two, the narrative of Lazarus and Olga arises. On the one hand, the objective narration of that part, you know, it's the sense, as it were, from Rora. On the other hand, whatever empathy and, you know, philosophical shadings in that narrative, they come from, and they come from Brick, as well as the moments where we can recognize that he's projecting himself into the narrative, that his pain and thoughts and doubts are projected into this narrative.
Well, the way the book is structured is it alternates between the 1908, I mean, Lazarus is sort of eliminated in the first chapter, and then it's all told really through Olga and her grief, and then what unfolds in Chicago, or the imagined things of what unfolds after Lazarus is killed, and Olga has to deal with it. And then we move from 1908 to 2004, when Brick and Rora have embarked on, like, the road trip to end all road trips, trying to, you know, go back into Lazarus Pass. And then at the same time, Brick is really finding out quite a bit about himself in a way that he wasn't really quite able to in the United States. But what I wanted to ask about, besides just that alternating structure, is that you have illustrated this book very consciously with a photograph at the beginning of each of these chapters. Some of them are from the Chicago Historical Society, and others were taken by your good friend, Velibor Bojovic, who, I mean, we try not to conflate you and your friend Velibor with, you know, Rora and Brick, but it's almost impossible since you went on this trip together to take pictures for this book. How did you end up, first of all, deciding that this book was going to be illustrated, and second of all, cull through 1,200 photographs to end up with, you know, the dozen that were included that Velibor took?
When we went on the trip to Eastern Europe, this was in 2003, in the summer of 2003, I had already had this outline. I mean, I did not have all the events that would take place in my head. But I knew that there would be Lazarus, the Lazarus part and the contemporary part. And the contemporary part, there would be the narrator and a photographer. And so when we went to Eastern Europe, and he knew this, obviously, because we talked about this, Velibor Božić, he's one of my best friends. In fact, he's my best friend. So we would sometimes, you know, sit around in a cafe in Lviv and speculate what would Rora see, or what he might be interested in photographing. In some ways, the way I describe this to myself and others when they asked, is that we were writing a script for the book. So, you know, we did take a trip, but I did take a trip so I could write about it, not because, you know, I wanted to find something about myself like Brick and then figured after the fact maybe I can write about this trip.
But the photographs are not identified, and I realize that, you know, everybody is left to sort of decide, well, what is this, a picture? Is this an illustration? They're almost more like punctuation than anything, because they're not defining something necessarily specific of what we're actually reading about in that chapter.
Well, I did avoid, you know, them being, putting them in a position where they illustrate something in the text. We, in fact, I could do a photo edit in which I would attach photos to particular points in the text. That is, if an old man with a hat is mentioned, we have a photo of an old man with a hat. If, you know, three men walking down the street are mentioned, we have a photo of three women walking down the street. But at some point, we decided to exclude those photos, not to have them illustrate something in the text, or even, as is the case in Sebald, often have them serve the function of saying to the reader, look, we were there. In Sebald's narratives, and Sebald would come up, has come up every time I talked about this book so far. You know, he has pictures of certain places which show that he, whoever he is, the narrator, Sebald himself, was there. And I excluded that. Out of 1,200 photos, there's a certain number of photos in which I stood in for Brick. That is, from afar, I wore this soccer jersey that was recognizable from afar, and all the photos were taken from behind. The idea, this was a coverage. I hadn't decided how to use the photos in the book yet. So we had a series of photos in which we would walk through these landscapes, and there would be a picture of, you know, a recognizable body, a little round like mine, and a number 7 on the back from a soccer jersey. Because I thought that maybe one of the ways to do it would be to have Brick in different situations in the book. Anyway, so there was exclusion of these photos, and Velibor did an edit and reduced all those photos, 1,200, to about 150. That was the initial edit, out of which I picked 12 of his that are in the book. And those are not the best photos from the point of view of, you know, photographic art. They're just the photos that could fit the narrative.
Well, none of the ones with the soccer jersey, are
no,
they?
No, they're all out. They're not very good, because I'm not good at posing, and he's not good at photographing posing people.
one of the things that that becomes clarified for Brick, and which I think does sort of link him also with Lazarus, and the idea of any immigrant in this country, and something which has appeared in pretty much all of your work before, is this idea, even when it was introducing you, everything that we know about you, everything we knew about Lazarus, everything we know pretty much about anybody who's immigrated, is what happens once they come here onto this territory. And so much of the book is about reconstructing Lazarus's life, whether through his sister's recollections or through going back to where he lived before he was an immigrant. And I thought it was really significant that back in 2004, you said in an interview that that what you have worked for is to be the same person I was before I got here. And this idea that there are these bifurcated lives, that there's a before and an after. And finally, when Brick goes on this journey, I think he becomes more and more aware that his life really has to be much more about the before than about the after.
But that's his loss. If you have a sense that there's a before and an after, then there's probably a trauma that is burdening you in your life. I think it's one of the symptoms of a trauma, that you have a sense of rupture in your life, that with whatever the event is that, you know, interrupted your life was split in two. And this is something that Brick sort of forgot at the beginning of the book. And then as he moves away from America, he becomes more and more aware of that. I have closed the rupture personally. This is why I'm not Brick, among other reasons. But I remember the process of this closure. I know what it means. And also I see it in a lot of people. Lazarus is not only an immigrant, but a refugee. And a lot of Bosnians I know and then are actually refugees, even now, after 10 or more years of being here. My parents will live a relatively comfortable life in Canada with a house and a backyard and a garden and all that. They still talk about it before and an after. You know, there was a rupture in their lives, and they could not close it because they were much older. And this is on top of you know, my personal human interest in that. It's an interesting narrative situation. That is the need on the one hand to close this gap between the before and the after, while at the same time telling the story of the before and the after. In other words, to take this, redressing the rupture, to take it as a narrative project, how to do that, while not closing the gaps and it becomes invisible. So it's all smooth, you know, as a lot of, how would I put it, a lot of, you know, immigrant mythology in this country is people came here, they fulfilled the American dream, they liked the old land, but they became the new happy people here, and, you know, the story's over. That sort of narrative covers up the rapture, and the gap, the abyss.
I thought it was kind of snarky, actually, that last week one of the New York papers mentioned this book as another entry into the growing genre of immigrant picaresque.
Yeah, well, we all the same today.
Okay, well, we're going to take
outside of Manhattan, the world is a flat place.
We are going to take a short break. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Thank you.
And you're listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and WFMT.com. This is Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who've published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. For readers, the Seminary Co-op Bookstores are a literary paradise because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores: the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend Richard Toller's and Cass Sunstein's Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, just published by Yale University Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Blue Balier's wonderful new book, The Calder Game, with illustrations by Brett Hellquist, published by Scholastic Press. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Alberto Mangel's Library at Night, also just released by Yale University Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and semcoop.com. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book The Lazarus Project with its author Alexander Heyman.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record. I want to remind everybody this is the last broadcast of the fourth season, although it will be. We are going to be running repeats on WFMT over the summer for the next 3 months. And we are going to kick off our fifth season at the Chicago Public Library starting in September at the Harold Washington Library, a new wonderful collaboration that we're going to begin. And it will continue to be broadcast on WFMT. In the meanwhile, if you really want to, you know, stay in touch, or if you missed some of the authors over the last four seasons, you can go to victorialoutman.com and click on Writers on the Record, and there you go. Martin Amis, Anne Lamott, Richard Price, the first interview with Sasha Heyman, Frank McCord, Edvige Donicott, they're all there, like three dozen. You can use it to put yourself to sleep, if nothing else. But we're talking to Alexander Heyman about the Lazarus Project, and one of the things that I thought was interesting is that Olga is this supremely important character in the book. She is Lazarus's older sister. Another very important sister appears in the book towards the end. That's Rora's sister, Azra. And the book is actually dedicated to your own sister, Christina. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something going on here with sisters. Like, all of a sudden, they seem these three women, or two in the book and possibly your own, have become lightning rods for something kind of important.
Well, my sister asked me, how come you never dedicate a book to me? So, and she is tough, so that was trouble, so I dedicated a book to her. But as for other sisters, initially I actually wanted, before I even put my pen on the paper, the idea was that I would write about Lazarus, but going backwards. That is, start with his death and then follow him back and tell his life, or, you know, that stretch of his life in reverse. But then I decided not to do that because I started thinking about Olga. Well, there's a beautiful picture of Olga, a few of them. And one of them is in the book. It's this beautiful, strong, sad woman that I could not stop thinking about. And I started writing about Olga. And also, I realized in some ways that, you know, we live in the memory of others. If I were writing about Lazarus alone, I would be inventing him, as it were. I would be speculating about his past, which is what Brick is doing in the book to some extent. But if Lazarus is seen through the eyes of Olga, this is an extra dimension and the real dimension, as it were. You know, unless someone remembers you, you dead in death. You completely gone and erased. So I wanted to have access, or the reader to have access to Lazarus through Olga and through her grief, and have Olga be central in that part of the narrative.
Well, why don't you read from this chapter that actually there is a quite remarkable photograph of her. And in this chapter, this is after Lazarus has been killed, and she has just had the most terrible, humiliating things occur to her, and yet, as you say, she remains really strong and sad.
It is late morning when Olga limps into the central police station, past a couple of policemen sniggering and exchanging lewd jokes about this disheveled tart, one shoe, heel missing. Olga announces to Deputy Sergeant Mulligan that she wishes to speak to Assistant Chief Schüttler. The sergeant laughs and says, "And who might you be, lassie?" But William P. Miller, lingering at the station in hope of a scoop, immediately recognizes she is dramatically distraught. Her Semitic features emanate fathomless suffering. Her olive skin has a tragic quality. One day, her people will sing songs about her. He whispers something into Mulligan's ear, and Mulligan shakes his large cubical head, dominated by a broken nose. Olga insists she must see Assistant Chief Schüttler, and Miller is already opening his notebook, pulling a pen like a comb out of his inside pocket. Olga Averbuch, strong-headed Jewess, suffering tragedienne, contains multitudes of stories. He puts on a charming grin and offers to walk her to Schüttler's office, but she does not even look at him. "You must consider having a bath, ma'am," Mulligan says to her back. Last night, the unwieldy, ungainly silence of the city would not allow her to sleep, reminding her of the absence. Lazarus's cheek was like marble, his hair straw dry. The policiant was murmuring in his sleep when she went to the outhouse, carrying a towel, her long velvet skirt and a knitted scarf in her bosom. He was still asleep when she came back, so that when Isidore, reeking of the cesspit, walked by him in woman's clothes, his face tucked into the scarf. He woke up only to utter a comment about stinking foreigners, but was too dazed to notice anything. It was her idea to go see Schüttler, hoping they wouldn't come to pick her up and find Isadore in her bedroom, folded painfully inside her wardrobe, behind a suitcase and a pile of rags. "This will be good practice," Isadore said, "for when you are married and I'm your lover." On her way to the police station, she imagined the Fitzes beating him with cheerful ardor as they beat Isak, presently gasping for air in his bed, his ribs thoroughly cracked. Even if he deserved a good beating, Isadore would never live through it. Some bones were never meant to be broken. Assistant Chief Schüttler is under the desk. It appears that he's looking for a cufflink or a dropped coin. She watches his bottom wiggling until he emerges from the kneeling position, slowly uncoiling himself like a snake. He looms over Olga, smoothing out his sleeves as she tries not to lean on her heels, on her heelless side. "You've come to confess the crimes of your brother, Miss Averbuch, perhaps denounce his anarchist companions, or tell us where we can find the young Maron." Defiantly, she faced Assistant Chief Schüttler, William P. Miller will write, she in her malodorous, immaculate robe, he in his impeccable, tailored suit, she with the wildness of the steppe gleaming in her eyes, he with the strength of law and order exhibited in his square, wide shoulders. It was a battle of wills. Masculine versus feminine, American versus Semitic, civilized versus anarchist. In no uncertain terms, the suffering woman demanded her brother's body back so that he could be buried according to the ancient Jewish rituals, howling foul words at Assistant Chief Schüttler, who stood stolidly facing her. She threatened with the wrath of the international Jews and depicted the modern-day apocalypse. With animal passion in her eyes, she promised long years of general terror, decades of anarchy that would destroy our freedom and everything we hold dear. But Assistant Chief Schüttler stared her straight in the eye. "Miss Averbuch," said he, "my job is to uphold law and order, and for law and order I must do what is best. Let your brother lie in peace, so this tormented city may finally return to tranquility." At that, the wounded Jewess stormed out, cursing with such foul fury that it would not have been out of place in hell itself. A policiant with a handlebar mustache slaps Olga's behind on the way out, and she totters out onto the street. Miller watches her, not laughing, even though the policeman nudges him. Like the sister of the biblical Lazarus, she would go to any length to save her brother. She walks randomly, crossing the street, only to cross back again. She finds herself lost in a maze of crates full of chickens and rabbits, then steps in front of a piebald horse, dragging a cart of pendant tin pots, hysterically banging against one another. The horse looks straight into her eyes, its eyelashes ridiculously long, and neighs, as if greeting her. She stops in front of a candy store, looking into the window, and not seeing the pink and the blue and the swirling candy, not seeing the licorice or the sugar cotton. A three-legged mutt runs up to her, as if recognizing her, and sniffs her. A newspaper boy shouts at the corner, "Washington to take the first step in purging the nation of foes to government and individual life." "Dear mother, this letter is coming from a better world. By the time you receive it, Lazarus and I will be together waiting for you." Thank you.
Olga writes a number of letters, imaginary, I think, letters home to her mother. She's just not capable of explaining anything about what's happened to her brother. And she's trying to bridge a gulf in her mind between the world she's living in and the one that her mother is in. And it reminds me a lot of what happens with Brick on his trip. I mean, the other really kind of important relationship in the book is his wife, Mary, the neurosurgeon. And as his friends, the Bosnians, predicted, this kind of dual marriage, although it maybe seems superficially to be a good thing, the more Brick is away from it, the more he realizes there is a chasm that just cannot be bridged. And one of the things that he says about Mary is that she's not able to see his deep face, that she's only able to see the face that he acquires in America, his recent face, but not the accumulation of faces. Again, this idea of before and after. And I think, you know, by the end of the book, it's pretty clear that his relationship with Mary is based on something that is not solid.
It is, but we only hear about Mary from Brick's mouth. So so we don't really know in the book. She never has a scene on her own. Brick is always present when Mary is talked about. In fact, he talks about Mary. So from that point of view, we don't really know what the situation is. In other words, it's not that he's blaming Mary, but he in his navel gazing, he sees only himself in relation to Mary rather than Mary. At one point, he actually manages to see Mary for who she is, but it's too late by that time. So Brick's problem, he has many, but as he moves away from America, his life, his own life, including Mary, becomes less real. The trip, the journey to Eastern Europe leads to a sense of this reality, to coin a word, where nothing that he thought his life was can actually hold together. And this is, in some ways, in opposition to the narrative of Lazarus and Olga, in a sense that that story is going somewhere, but also Olga's life within that story is something that she cannot hold together. And I did not, you know, specifically say that Brick identifies with Olga as such, but if there is a point of identification in the Lazarus part of the book, the point of identification for Brick, that it would be Olga.
By the way, if somebody's interested in asking a question, this is a good time to make your way to one of the two microphones, and we would be happy to take your questions. But in the meanwhile, I want to go back just for a moment, and I know you really hate questions about, well, what's real and what isn't real and what part was the research and what wasn't, but just indulge me here. When you and Vebo go on your trip recreating or writing the script, trying to work out the script, and it's almost like this crazy parallax view. Like you write a script about a book that is about to be written, that's being written by this other character. And so much about that journey is just, it's fascinating. It's this almost this wasteland of Eastern Europe. It's lawless. It just seems like almost like the fifth circle of hell, or one of the circles anyway. And they keep encountering these terrible characters, some nice people, but they observe brutality. There's a lot of prostitutes. Even when they try and get a glass to drink whiskey out of or something, prostitutes arrive at their door. At one point, they're transporting a woman across the lines of country lines, and she's being trafficked. And it just, what they're encountering is just so outside the realm of what most of us see in our daily lives, these thugs with guns poking out of their waistbands.
It's freedom and democracy in Eastern Europe.
Right. Well, so how much of that is actually accurate in what you and Vebo really encountered?
Well, we didn't really transport anyone across the border. We did have a crazy driver, and I wish I could have beaten him up, but I didn't. He was a maniac, in fact. But the way I operate as a writer and as a person is that I extend beyond myself. I start with a personal thing, and then I imagine beyond that. And on the more, you know, blatantly, I simply imagine an alternative outcome of this situation. I once spent time in a coffee shop somewhere. A woman was sitting, and it was outdoors, and a woman was sitting, and a bee flew around her head, and then she, you know, waved it away, and that was the end of reality. But I spent some time imagining, what if the bee kept attacking her, and her husband, who was sitting next to her boyfriend, did not help her, and the whole marriage fell apart right there in front of my eyes because of a bee. And I never wrote this down, not even a note. I only remember this because at this moment I recognized that I could define my method in this situation. This I do all the time. It's compulsive. Most of it never reaches the paper. Most of it never lives longer than, you know, half an hour, if that. So when we went on a trip, this is what I did. So we did go from Chisinau to Bucharest in a hired car. And the driver was a lunatic and nearly killed us, but there was no prostitute. But he was clearly a thug and clearly had, you know, some other businesses in Bucharest and along the way. And so I started imagining, what if there was a fourth person here? And so I do this all the time. As for Eastern Europe, it's a long and sad story, but in Moldova, just an example, which is a small country of 4 million people, 1 million people have left. And many of them illegally. There's a huge trafficking problem where women are essentially kidnapped and taken to Bosnia, Kosovo, Middle East, and Western Europe. I spoke to a journalist in Moldova who was doing a story on that, and one of the things that struck me was that it was not a mafia operation. It was a small business operation. There is a couple would open a fake travel agency and promise young Moldovan women that they would get them a job in a hotel in Greece or Portugal or somewhere, and then they would take them across the border and deliver them then, once they were beyond the borders of Moldova and Romania, they would deliver them to the network, trafficking network. So the sadness there is extremely real. The infrastructure in many of those countries has been wiped out. So you have the criminal elite, which is indistinguishable from a political elite, and the people who have sunk to the bottom and are just trying to stay alive. In doing so, they emigrate, you know, in hope that something good might happen.
Let's take a couple of questions here, Sasha.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Heyman, for your work. I've read each of the projects that you've done and really felt challenged and enriched by them. So thank you very much for that. In the Lazarus Project, one thing I reflected on a lot in Brick was his what felt like his journey both into the past to try and understand the murder, but then also in some ways to kind of understand and accept himself. And I guess one thing I'd be interested in hear your thoughts about is it seemed like for him, his return to a country where he had left before this huge trauma had happened within the country, which was something he had not experienced, by returning there, he gained something of himself. But the way in which you have so many different sources telling us what's real and what's not, where Mr. Miller has an insight that he's sort of good at telling stories, even as he's writing it, really challenged how we sort of know what is real and what is not real and what kind of acceptance is and what meaning is. So I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because I was reflecting a lot about that after reading your work.
Well, that's a tricky question. There was a survey, or study, in fact, and it was written up in the New York Times that showed, which was surprising apparently to some people, but not to me, or anyone who may have read, say, Madame Bovary, that people imagine their lives as a story, and then they cast themselves as a character in that story, and then they act accordingly. You know, most obviously, someone might imagine themselves as courageous and, you know, rebellious, although in reality they might not be like that. But then they often act according to this, you know, fantasy of themselves. In other words, to identify yourself to yourself and to others, you have to put yourself in a particular narrative. This narrative is at the same time real because you act according to this narrative and it determines your life, but it's also unreal because it's a fantasy of yourself. And the whole notion of a fantasy of yourself, which is, you know, how this book might be described, it is not me, but it could be me, or it is me as I imagine myself, makes the fantasy of yourself, makes it, you know, makes the border between real and unreal murky. This is not necessarily a postmodern thing where everything's equally real. The Holocaust is more real than non-Holocaust. That should never be questioned. History is real. Things have happened. People have died. But in a situation of, how would I put it, narrative self-identification, the borders are necessarily blurred. What Brick does is sort of, he, you know, taps around himself in the darkness. And then in doing so, he imagines himself in a particular way. This trip breaks down his fantasy from America, as it were. He cannot sustain this fantasy, a fantasy of an intercultural marriage for him. So, you know, I'm the reality and this reality in the book. It's not the purpose of that, of stating that problem, as it were, is not to make everything unreal and just, you know, let's all fantasize. But it's directly and deeply related to the question of identity.
Let's have another question. Thanks.
I'm very struck by the fact that you began this book in 2003 and you write about an anarchist of 1908. It seems to me that I associate anarchy with, like, the Haymarket riots of in Chicago. But I think we do have this perception of anarchy today, except we call them terrorists. So that's one observation. My question is this. As someone who has come to this country from another country, I think of another author named Joseph Conrad, who was Hungarian and who adopted English as his language in which to write. I wonder if Conrad's story is relevant to your situation, and I'm wondering what you find as the problem of writing in English, because this is not your native tongue. So therefore, is English your preferred language now?
Conrad was Polish, and this is not to correct you, but it was relevant because Poland was not a country at the time. So it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So when he left Poland, it wasn't, and, you know, started sailing on ships, it wasn't just for a better life, but because in some ways he did not have a defined, as narrowly defined a cultural identity as one has it if you come from a defined country with a history and a flag and all that. And I do, it's not that I identify with Conrad, but Conrad is interesting to me because of the situation and his writing. He's not my favorite author, I have to say. And what is interesting to me, how in some ways he became British, but in a different way. He announces a different models of British identity. As for my English, I write fiction in English, but I write a column for a magazine in Sarajevo, in Bosnia. I have an equal amount of words, as it were, published in English and Bosnian. The genres are different, and the modes of this, the means of dissemination are different. I've talked about this before, maybe even the last time I was here, but to write in any language, it has to become part of your subconscious mind. It has to be at home in your subconscious mind. This obviously happens with your native language very early. It just is embedded there. You don't have to do anything to, you know, activate it. And you have to read a lot, I assume, to write, I mean, literary fiction or any kind of fiction. So you can have a vast vocabulary, which I did in English at a certain point. But English, the English language has entered, and I'm not entirely sure how and whether it would happen now in this situation, has entered my subconscious mind in the early 90s. And I know this, or I can claim this, because I remember dreaming in English and then noticing in my dream that I shouldn't be dreaming in English. That is, people in my dream were speaking English and I was surprised in my dream. And more bizarrely, I remember remembering in English things that had not happened in English. That is, conversations with my friends from Sarajevo and such things that I recall in English. And now I can't notice or I don't care whether I'm dreaming or remembering in either of those languages, because it's all the old inside. But at that time, it was you know, surprising to me. Why am I remembering this in English? The explanation that I have is that somehow, for some reason, under a kind of extreme pressure in the early 90s, at the time of the war, and my the beginning of my life here, my subconscious mind, the parts thereof, were being translated into English. The English language was entering it and embedding itself and making home for itself in my brain. And now that it's in my brain, until my brain fades, it's the same. Writing in Bosnian and English, there's no difference at all in the method. I don't have to do anything special for writing in English.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but one thing I did want to ask you is that you're sort of denial or reluctance to call Nowhere Man a novel. You said it was elected a novel, and that at one point you had this series of letters you wrote back and forth to Nathan Englander, who had been on this show, saying that the idea of writing a novel was just something that you couldn't really get past. And almost the idea of a linear narrative was something that was impossible at one point for you to embark on. And I think because of this idea of a trauma of being, you know, uprooted from a life unasked for, and that really writing in a fractured way, as your two earlier books were, was the only way to really approach writing. And yet now you've sat down and written an actual novel from the start. So this must be almost in a way a way of showing that, yes, that period of your life is now over, you've healed, or am I being too simplistic about it? And why
no,
did you decide to?
It is, in fact, I don't know if it's progress, but it's the next step in some ways. It is formally more simple, less chaotic, this book. But even this book, I could not call it a novel until I submitted the manuscript. I referred to it as the big book. And I could not, it was only after I sent the manuscript to my editor did I wake up one morning and thought, it seems that I wrote a novel. It feels like a novel. Because deciding to write a novel, it first imposes all kinds of limits to my mind. I prefer not to know what I'm doing. In fact, I've been writing in various ways for 20 years. And one of the things that I've learned is that what I experience is every time I'm writing something, whether it's a story or a book, there's a moment where I think, I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea where I'm going. And it is that moment that makes it exciting. It is after that, you know, an extra boost kicks in. And then I really want to finish it to see what I'm doing. And so to start, you know, to say I'm writing a novel now is to say, all right, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to sit down now, work, you know, a few hours every day, and I'm going to write a novel. How hard is that? Whereas my starting position is I have no idea what I'm doing, and I'm going to keep doing it until I figure it out.
Well, thank you for coming back as our only second guest on Writers on the Record, Sasha Heyman. And the book is The Lazarus Project. And all of you have a marvelous summer. I hope you will tune into WFMT. And I hope to see you at the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Center in the fall. Thank you all very, very much. Most of all, you, Alexander
Heyman.
Thank
you. Great pleasure to be here.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. If you want to hear over the summer, please consult WFMT.com or our program guide for schedules on rebroadcasts. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft and House Manager Chad Wachob. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunis is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. Host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record are made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. At 98.7 FM, this is WFMT Chicago, and on the Internet, this is WFMT.com. Stay tuned for the BP, Chicago Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast.